5. How 80-20 running improves skill. Imagine for a moment that some clever chemist has developed a serum with the power to equalize running fitness among all who ingest it. Just swallow 2 drops, and instantly you have exactly the same amount of running fitness as everyone who has done the same. Now, let's say that you and 99 other runners who have sampled the serum compete in a 10K race. What will happen? Will all of you tie for first place? Not a chance. The reason is that fitness is not the only factor that determines running performance. A separate factor is running skill. To be a skillful runner is to have an efficient stride. The standard measure of stride efficiency is running economy, which is roughly equivalent to automobile fuel economy. Whereas fuel economy is represented as the amount of fuel required to travel a given distance, running economy is represented as the amount of oxygen required to sustain a given speed. All runners become more economical through training, which is to say that they exhibit a trend toward requiring less oxygen to sustain the same speeds. In the preceding chapter, I describe how Paula Radcliffe achieved huge improvements in race performance through de facto 80-20 training. I attributed these improvements largely to gains in brain fitness. But improved skill also played a part. Radcliffe submitted to periodic tests of running economy over the course of her career and was observed to become significantly more efficient as time went by. Whereas fitness has to do with how certain internal organs such as the heart and brain function, running skill has to do with how the body moves. There is something special about a skilled runner's movements that gives him or her the ability to run at the same pace as a less skillful runner with less effort. Some coaches believe this something special is good form or correct technique. In all sports, not just running, the term technique refers to gross movement patterns, particularly of the limbs, which are describable in terms of angles, frequencies, and so forth. The elements of correct running technique, according to tradition, include a high stride rate, a low stride length, relative to speed, a midfoot or forefoot foot strike, and minimal vertical oscillation or bouncing. The typical elite runner has most or all of these stride attributes. The average back-of-the-pack runner, on the other hand, has few or none. Technique-focused running coaches try to instill these characteristics in the strides of runners who lack them, assuming that a slow runner who's able to make his or her stride look more like a fast runner stride must get faster as a result. But this assumption turns out to be false. Research has consistently shown that forced alterations to an individual's natural running form almost always worsen performance instead of improving it. So if correct technique is not the something special about a runner's movements that constitutes the essence of skillful running, then what is it? Arthur Lydiard hinted at an alternative in his celebrated 1962 article in Sports Illustrated. That article contained exactly one paragraph on the topic of form. In 4 short sentences, Lydiard said everything he felt a runner needed to know about the matter. "Forget about form," he wrote. "If a joker throws his arms around, that's fine, so long as he is fit and relaxed. Then he runs smoother and easier, and form takes care of itself. We want the chap who can run for 2 or 3 hours and come back looking as fit as he did when he went out." This was Lydiard's way of saying that there are a lot of great runners who lack textbook form. But all great runners exhibit a subtler quality that we might call relaxed, smooth ease. Unlike correct technique, this other quality actually matters to performance. The more relaxed a runner's stride is, the more resistant that runner is to fatigue. Whereas good running form can be taught to no avail, relaxed, smooth ease is self-taught, or rather self-learned, emerging naturally through the normal fitness-building process. A low-intensity, high-volume, i.e. 80-20, approach to training is not only the most effective way to build running fitness, but is also the best method of developing relaxed, smooth ease, which is the true essence of running skill. These ideas prove to be remarkably prescient. Only since Lydiard's death in 2004 has science defined relaxed, smooth ease and shown that simply running more without trying to imitate some image of perfect running form is truly the best way to become a more skillful runner. New studies have demonstrated that relaxed, smooth ease is the visible manifestation of an acquired quietness in parts of the brain that control the body's movements, a sort of neurological efficiency earned through relentless practice that allows the stride to be more adaptive. The ultimate mark of skillful running is the ability to run with minimal mental effort. This quiescence of the brain is distinct from the brain-based tolerance for suffering that I described in the last chapter. To return to our earlier thought experiment, in a 10K race between serum-doped runners of precisely equal fitness, the winner is likely to be the one who has the quietest brain. And this runner is also likely to be the one who does the most slow running. The cost of correction. Historically, formal technique instruction has had a small place in the sport of running. The reason is that most of the top coaches have shared Lydiard's belief that good form is not the true essence of skillful running. But within the past decade or so, a flood of technique-focused coaches has come into the sport. There are many different schools of running technique instruction, but underneath their disparate labels, they aren't much different from one another. Whether they call it chi running, the pose method, evolution running, natural running, or something else, the coaches who teach correct form all have pretty much the same thing in mind when they think about proper running technique: a high stride rate, a low stride length, minimal bouncing, and so forth. It is not at all difficult to teach a high stride rate or any of these other characteristics to a runner who lacks it. The process is not unlike learning dance steps. The instructor demonstrates, the student imitates, the instructor corrects, and boom, the dance is mastered. So it is reasonable to assume, as technique-focused coaches do, that teaching a runner to consciously imitate the movements of better runners will make him or her faster. But in this case, what makes sense in theory backfires in practice. Research stretching back more than 40 years has consistently demonstrated that forced corrections to a runner's natural form almost always worsen running economy instead of improving it. Take stride length, for example. The effects of changes in stride length on running economy have been extensively studied. The most influential study in this line of research was conducted by Peter Cavanaugh in 1982. One of the preeminent biomechanists of his generation, Cavanaugh recruited 10 runners and had them run at stride lengths ranging from 20% greater than their natural stride length to 20% less without changing their pace. All 10 runners consumed the least oxygen, meaning they were most economical, at precisely their natural stride length. In other words, any change to their preferred stride length made them less efficient. Cavanaugh concluded that runners either naturally adopt the movement patterns that are most efficient for them, or they adapt to their chosen movement patterns so that these patterns become maximally efficient over time. As for bouncing, in a 2012 study, a team of Swedish researchers led by Kjartan Halvorsen supplied a group of 16 male runners with visual and auditory feedback that was intended to reduce the amount of vertical displacement in their stride. It worked. All of the subjects were able to trim some of the wasteful excess bouncing from their stride. Unfortunately, it turned out the extra bouncing wasn't wasteful at all. Changing their natural stride in this way made the runners less, not more, efficient. The same thing happens when scientists meddle with runners' natural foot strike. One study found that experienced runners who were natural forefoot strikers and those who were natural heel strikers had equal running economy, and that neither group became more economical when forced to switch. While a forefoot running style is commonly regarded as superior, the reality is that a heel striking style is more economical for those runners who come to this form naturally and unconsciously. Defenders of the notion that there is only one correct way to run insist that all runners can become more efficient if their stride is changed to look more like the ideal. They just need time to adjust to such corrections. It isn't realistic, say these coaches, to expect a runner to become more economical the very instant her form is fixed. Given a chance to practice her new and improved technique, however, she will eventually become more efficient. But the evidence does not support this hope. For example, in a 2005 study, researchers at the University of Cape Town switched 16 experienced triathletes from a heel strike to a forefoot strike and gave them 12 full weeks to practice their new running style under expert supervision. At the end of those 12 weeks, the subjects were still less economical than they had been with their natural foot strike. Self-optimization. The fact that any and all changes to a runner's natural stride worsen performance instead of improving it has caused some scientists to speculate that the stride is a self-optimizing system. In Chapter 3, we heard that the sport of running itself is a kind of self-optimizing system where training methods evolve over time to produce ever faster runners. Many experts in biomechanics now believe that each runner's stride automatically becomes more efficient over time, so that conscious changes in technique are always unnecessary and usually counterproductive. Support for this belief comes from children. Young children who have just learned how to run are far less efficient than adults are. There are certain metabolic reasons for this disparity, but there are biomechanical reasons too. In particular, young children tend to overstride, taking steps that are longer than their most energy-efficient stride length. As boys and girls get older, however, their stride evolves to become increasingly efficient. This happens regardless of whether a child becomes a jogger or a competitive runner. Playground scampering seems to be sufficient, but it happens more quickly in children who do train as runners. Formal technique instruction, though, does not improve running economy in children any more than it does in adults. Science has shown that in adults, running economy improves drastically within weeks of the commencement of regular training. In 2012, Sharon Dixon of the University of Exeter, England, measured changes in a number of stride features as well as changes in running economy in a group of 10 beginner female runners. These women trained for 10 weeks without any technique instruction. They just ran. During that period, their running economy improved by 8.4%. This improvement was associated with no fewer than 7 subtle changes in the women's stride characteristics. For example, peak dorsiflexion of the ankle tended to occur later in the stance phase of the stride after training than it did before. If you're not entirely sure what this means, well, that's kind of the point. Neither did the participants in the study. They were completely unconscious of the adjustment. And in any case, it is not the kind of thing that can be learned by imitation. Such subtle and complexly coordinated efficiency-boosting stride changes must happen on their own if they are going to happen at all. If the running stride does indeed self-optimize for efficiency, it must do so through a specific biological mechanism. One possibility is that the brain somehow monitors the body's rate of oxygen consumption and captures movement patterns that minimize oxygen usage. But the latest research suggests that the stride self-optimizes through an entirely different mechanism. A 2012 study found evidence that the brain in fact monitors muscle activation and latches onto patterns that yield equal speed with less muscle work, a process that would reduce the oxygen cost of running as a side effect. This finding lines up with research in other endurance sports, which suggests that it is not oxygen usage, but muscle work that the body seeks to minimize in its pursuit of more efficient movement. For example, cyclists naturally adopt a pedaling cadence that does not quite minimize oxygen consumption, but does minimize muscle activation. While muscle activation and oxygen consumption are linked, such that they tend to increase and decrease together, they are not identical. Most exercise scientists continue to treat oxygen consumption as the definitive marker of running economy. But, If it's true that muscle activation is the true object of the brain's monitoring efforts, then the use of oxygen consumption as a proxy for running skill may be misleading at times. Whatever the mechanism is by which the running stride evolves toward greater efficiency, it is not open to conscious manipulation. No runner can reduce the number of muscle fibers that he or she uses to sustain a given running speed through an act of will. I mean, what would you do if you were running along and a coach shouted out, "Okay, keep going at that pace, but do it by recruiting less total muscle mass"? If the running stride is truly self-optimizing, though, then why don't all experienced runners look exactly the same when they run? Because no two runners have the same body. Each human body is unique in its structure and neuromuscular wiring. Consequently, while all runners automatically become more economical by reducing muscle activation, all runners do not reduce muscle activation in the same manner. A certain degree of convergence in running form does occur as runners gain experience. For example, as I mentioned before, most runners shorten their stride unconsciously through practice. But even the best runners in the world retain idiosyncrasies that defy the standard image of correct form. Meb Keflezighi, winner of the 2009 New York City Marathon and the 2014 Boston Marathon, is a heel striker. Ryan Hall, American record holder in the half marathon, is bouncy, exhibiting more than twice as much vertical displacement as other elite runners. Mo Farah, winner of 5 Olympic and World Championship gold medals at 5,000 and 10,000 meters, takes just 160 steps per minute, far fewer than the 180 that is considered ideal. Technique-focused coaches look at these runners and wrongly think, "Wow, imagine how much better they would be if they only fixed their form." Other coaches look at the same runners, as Arthur Lydiard did, and correctly conclude that there must be a difference between good form and skillful running. The freedom factor. When we characterize an individual runner's stride in terms of qualities such as stride rate, stride length, and vertical displacement, an important feature is overlooked: variability. No two strides taken by an individual runner are identical. Like a snowflake, each stride is slightly different from any other stride taken by the same runner. If you watch a runner gliding along at a steady pace on a smooth, level surface, it may appear as though every stride is the same, but sensitive instruments such as accelerometers can pick up small variations in movement patterns that the naked eye can't. Some runners exhibit greater variability in their stride than others do. Generally, experienced runners and fitter runners have the most variable strides, beginners the least. This might seem counterintuitive. You might have supposed that a runner's stride would become less variable as he or she became fitter and more experienced. But in fact, the opposite happens. This phenomenon is not unique to running. Athletes in all sports become more varied in their movement patterns as they become more skillful. Variation in the running stride is best thought of as a kind of freedom of movement or looseness. Could it be that the extra looseness that exists in the strides of fitter and more experienced runners is the very quality that coaches like Arthur Lydiard have perceived as relaxed, smooth ease? I believe it is. But where does this freedom come from? And why does it increase automatically with experience and fitness? The answers to these questions, as I've already hinted, are to be found in the brain. Muscle fibers are activated by the brain. Before the brain activates a collection of muscle fibers to perform a specific motor task, it first creates a mental plan or blueprint for the action. Scientists now have the ability to take snapshots of the brain during this planning stage, just before a movement is initiated. What they have found is that the brain never creates the same plan for the same action twice. No matter how basic and familiar the movement is, the brain creates a slightly different plan for it each time the act is performed. This suggests that the brain is simply unable to perfectly duplicate any given movement plan. If this is true, it can only be because nature wants our movements to be variable. Inconsistency in movements such as running must be somehow beneficial. The inability of the brain to precisely recreate a plan for a movement, such as the running stride, explains why no two strides taken by any single runner are ever the same. But it does not explain why some runners exhibit more variability than others do, or why variability tends to increase with experience. The explanation for these patterns has to do with how the brain changes in the process of practicing a motor skill. Brain imaging studies have revealed that several areas of the brain that are highly active during the initial phase of learning a new motor skill, including the cerebellum, premotor cortex, basal ganglia, presupplemental motor area, and supplementary motor area, become less active as skill increases. Other brain regions become more active, but the overall pattern of brain activity over the course of the motor learning process has been characterized as specific increases with global decreases. As practice continues, parts of the brain whose job is to represent the particular body parts that are involved in the task actually grow. Additionally, myelin, a sheath of fatty insulating material, forms around the neural connections that are most often used in the task, improving signal transmission. As these structural changes unfold, brain activity during task performance becomes less diffuse and more synchronized, hence more efficient. Experienced and skilled athletes in all sports exhibit less brain activity, or what I call a quieter brain, than others do when performing sport-specific actions. And, as I mentioned earlier, experienced and skilled athletes in all sports also exhibit more variation in their movements. These two phenomena are linked. Experienced and skilled athletes exhibit more variation in their movements because their brain is quieter. The harder the brain is working to control the movements, the more constrained those movements become. Better athletes don't have to exert as much mental effort to control their sport-specific movements, so their movements are freer. Perhaps an analogy will make this idea more understandable. Think of a novice athlete's brain as being like a supervisor who micromanages his staff. Employees who work under a micromanager tend to conform to a rigid standard of behavior in response to their boss's constant meddling. Similarly, a novice athlete's movement tends to be rigidly repetitive as a consequence of the brain's intensive efforts to control the body. In contrast, an experienced athlete's brain is like a hands-off supervisor. Employees who work under a laid-back boss tend to bring different styles to the performance of their duties. Analogously, the loose control of the body's movements that is exerted by an experienced athlete's brain allows the limbs to move more freely, hence more variably, from one repetition to the next. In runners, a quiet brain yields a subtle play in the stride that observers may perceive as a sort of effortlessness. So we've clarified the relationship between a quiet brain and a more variable stride, or relaxed, smooth ease. But one important question remains unanswered. Why are these things good? In other words, precisely how does a runner benefit from having a quieter brain and a looser stride? To answer this question, I must enlist the help of robots. A lesson from robots. One of the most important insights that scientists have gained concerning how humans run and walk has come out of efforts to create robots that are able to walk and run like humans. The first two-legged walking machine was created in 1893. This machine was indeed a machine, not a robot, because it was entirely mechanical and did not contain an internal computer that controlled its movements. It wasn't until 1966 that the first computer-controlled two-legged walking robot was built. This invention simulated human locomotion better than any mere walking machine because the computer that controlled its movements assumed the role that the human brain executes in walking and running. Nevertheless, there were important differences between the actions of the first walking robots and real human locomotion. One difference was that robot walking was completely non-adaptive. The first walking robots, could do only what they were programmed to do in exactly the way they were programmed to do it. They cannot learn to do it better or alter their movements in response to changes in their environment, such as encountering a slope. Also, the movements of the first walking robots just didn't look human. They were missing a certain grace and fluidity. Engineers tried to solve these problems by creating robots with greater and greater computational power. The idea was to pre-program the robots with a rote reaction to every circumstance they could possibly encounter. The best robots of this type were capable of performing thousands of calculations per millisecond in an effort to exert total control over their movements. But it was all for naught. No matter how sophisticated a robot's movements program was, it could never attain true adaptability in this way. And the resources required of the attempt to exert total control were immense. If a living creature had to put so much effort into ambulating, it would never survive in a natural world that rewards efficiency and ruthlessly punishes waste. Then, some engineers had another idea. They went back to a concept first proposed by a Russian neurophysiologist named Nikolai Bernstein in the 1930s. Bernstein believed that most of the work of coordinating the body's movements during locomotion was done not by the brain itself, but rather by reflexes located throughout the body. The brain was involved only at an executive level, making decisions about which direction to turn and how fast to go, and responding to novel circumstances that the reflexes were not prepared for. Based on this concept, roboticists developed the robot equivalent of a quiet brain, which controlled movements loosely instead of rigidly. In 2008, the German computational neuroscientist Florentin Vergeter unveiled Runbot, a walking and running robot whose movements were controlled by a few simple rules that left plenty of room for adjustments based on feedback from sensors positioned at key locations in the robot's body. Unlike its predecessors, Runbot was able to learn on its own how to do things it had not been explicitly programmed to do, such as walk up and down slopes, and its movements were decidedly more graceful. Subsequent designs, including DARPA's Petman, have taken the quiet brain approach further, yielding movements that are increasingly adaptive, efficient, and lifelike. The lesson that the Runbot breakthrough taught scientists about human locomotion was that loosely controlled movements allow for improvement, whereas rigidly controlled movements do not. A robot that adapts its movement patterns based on feedback about the environment from its body may start off moving less skillfully than a robot that was programmed to exhibit perfect form, but in the end, it will be more skillful because it can learn and its rival can't. Likewise, in human runners, a more loosely controlled stride is better able to self-optimize for greater efficiency. While all beginners tend to be highly conscious of their stride and therefore more rigid in their movements, there is a spectrum. Runners who start off with a little more natural play in the stride become more efficient faster. This pattern holds for all motor tasks, not just running. Yosuke Miyamoto of Harvard University, himself a former world-class swimmer, has demonstrated that individuals who exhibit greater movement variability when initially performing an unfamiliar hand-eye coordination task are able to improve faster than those who exhibit less variation. The adaptability that comes with loosely controlled movements not only facilitates short-term and long-term skill improvement, but it also has an immediate positive effect on efficiency. The overall circumstances in which motor skills such as the running stride are performed are fluid. They are never precisely the same from one moment to the next. Therefore, continuous adaptation in movement patterns is required to maintain a high level of efficiency. Between one run and the next, a runner's body changes in small ways that demand small degrees of adaptation in the stride. In fact, even within a single run, there is a need to adapt. Your body is not the same at the 5-mile mark of a moderate intensity threshold run as it was at the beginning. For this reason, The stride pattern that is most efficient for you when you're fresh is no longer optimal when you're tired. If you have a quiet brain that is receptive to external feedback, you will be better able to adapt your stride to fatigue in order to maintain your stride's efficiency. This was demonstrated in a 2007 study conducted by Ian Hunter at Brigham Young University. 16 experienced runners were asked to run for 1 hour on treadmills at a challenging pace. Hunter's team measured the stride rates of the runners near the beginning of the run, when they were fresh, and near the end, when they were tired. A runner's stride rate usually decreases as fatigue increases. And that's what happened in this experiment. Exercise scientists have tended to assume that this change is a bad thing, a sign that fatigue is causing a runner's form to deteriorate. Hunter had another suspicion. He hypothesized that the change in stride rate was in fact a spontaneous adaptation to fatigue that served to preserve efficiency. Turned out, he was right. At both measurement points in the run, Hunter required the subjects to run at each of five different stride rates: their natural stride rate, 4 and 8% above their natural stride rate, and 4 and 8% below their natural stride rate. He discovered that the runner's natural stride rate was most efficient at both points, even though their natural stride rate decreased over the course of the run. Here is powerful evidence that efficient running is about the brain listening to the body more than it is about the brain telling the body what to do. If the runners in this study had made a conscious effort to maintain their original stride rate throughout the run in spite of mounting fatigue, they would have spoiled their efficiency. Instead, they allowed unconscious parts of their brain to adjust the stride in response to fatigue signals from the body and thereby preserve efficiency. Developing relaxed, smooth ease. Becoming a more skillful and efficient runner is more like growing a beard than it is like chopping wood. In other words, you don't make it happen, you allow it to happen. The true essence of skillful running is not correct movements of the limbs, but a quiet brain. Therefore, the proper goal of all efforts to improve running skill is to reduce brain activity during the act of running. Any measure that helps a runner run more unconsciously is guaranteed to result in better performance. Likewise, any measure that increases brain activation during running will worsen performance. Consciously altering your natural stride is one such measure. Devoting any more conscious attention to your stride than is strictly necessary is like reverting to an earlier stage in your development as a runner, when the stride action was less familiar and intense self-consciousness was unavoidable. Numerous studies have shown that people move less skillfully and learn motor tasks more slowly when they are required to focus their attention on their body. A few of these experiments have involved running. A 2009 study by German researchers, for example, found that runners were less economical when thinking about the movements of their bodies as they ran than when they were focusing on their breathing, and were less economical when focused on their breathing than they were when they paid attention to the environment around them. What's most interesting about these findings is that the runner's biomechanics did not change across the three conditions. Only their brain activity changed. So it appears that forced corrections to the stride reduce efficiency not only by dislodging runners from the natural movement patterns they have developed through experience, but also by forcing runners to think harder about what they're doing. If consciously changing your natural stride is not the best way to enhance your running skill, then what is? As we heard at the beginning of the chapter, Arthur Lydiard believed that high-volume training was the secret to developing relaxed, smooth ease, which he correctly identified as the visible mark of skillful running. Given what we now know about the self-optimizing nature of the stride, we should indeed expect that simply running more would be the surest way to accelerate the acquisition of relaxed, smooth ease. The three key characteristics of a self-optimizing system are variation, selection, and repetition. Variation is built into the neuromuscular system. Because no two strides that you take are exactly the same, Each stride constitutes a small experiment. Your next stride may be slightly more efficient than the one before, requiring less muscle activation to sustain the same pace, or slightly less efficient. If it's more efficient, your brain is likely to select it, remembering key details of the activation pattern that produced it, and incorporating them into the blueprint for your stride, thus making it more efficient generally. Obviously, you can't make much progress toward optimization with a single stride. It takes many thousands of strides to make measurable gains. That's where repetition comes in. High-volume training packs more strides into less time, resulting in faster progress. And keeping the intensity low most of the time, in other words, following the 80-20 rule, allows you to run more without burning out. So the best way to become a more skillful runner is identical to the best way to maximize your running fitness. But although relaxed, smooth ease comes from the same source that running fitness comes from, it is an entirely separate thing. This was demonstrated in a clever study done by my friend Stephen McGregor, an exercise scientist at Eastern Michigan University. The purpose of this study was to distinguish the effects of high-volume running on fitness from its effects on running skill. To do this, McGregor recruited two groups of subjects, college runners and competitive triathletes. Both groups underwent two kinds of testing. A standard VO2 max test was used to measure the aerobic fitness of the runners and the triathletes. In addition, accelerometers were used to measure the amount of variability, or relaxed smooth ease, in the strides of the two groups. McGregor found that VO2 max, or fitness, was about the same in the two groups. But the runners exhibited more variability in their stride, indicating they were more skillful. McGregor attributed these findings to differences in training. The total training loads of the two groups of athletes were comparable, and that's why their fitness scores were roughly the same. But whereas the triathletes divided their training time among three disciplines, swimming, cycling, and running, the runners did nothing but run, and that's why their strides exhibited more relaxed, smooth ease. McGregor had proved that the more running a person does, the freer and more efficient his or her stride becomes, independent of changes in fitness. Simply repeating the stride action over and over as much as possible, without interference, is the secret to becoming a more skillful runner. Arthur Lydiard had it right in 1962. If you want a better stride, all you have to do is run enough so that eventually you can run for 2 or 3 hours without looking any less fresh at the end than you did at the beginning, and your form will take care of itself. Running at low intensity most of the time, specifically 80% of the time, will enable you to run more so you can take fuller advantage of this natural process.